Imagine you are a farmer living in a tiny village in 9th century France.
Right.
You've just made it through this brutally wet, freezing spring. You harvest your rye crop, you mill it into flour, and you bake your daily
A
bread.
staple of life.
Exactly. You feed it to your family, you eat it yourself. I mean, it is sustenance, it's survival. But by nightfall, your neighbor is suddenly screaming, totally convinced he's being dragged into hell by invisible demons.
Which is terrifying.
Completely. And then a few days later, your own fingers and toes start to burn with this agonizing, unquenchable fire. A week after that, your hand turns pitch black, dies, and literally falls off your arm.
Yeah, dry gangrene.
Right. And you think you've been cursed by God, naturally, but the truth is actually hiding right there in your bread. And roughly 1,000 years later, that exact same curse will be extracted, modified in this, pristine Swiss laboratory, and used to create the most famous psychedelic in human history.
LSD.
Yeah, it feels.
It honestly sounds like dark fantasy, but it is entirely strictly biological fact. I mean, we are looking at a substance that has played the role of both a mass murderer and a modern medical miracle.
Which is exactly why we are so thrilled you're joining us for this deep dive today. We're pulling all of this from an incredibly comprehensive, frankly mind-bending article in the OTW Journal.
Yeah, from July 23, 2026.
Right, titled Ergot, the Fungus That Birthed LSD. And our mission today is to essentially trace the journey of one very specific chemical, backbone lysergic acid, through human history, through the human bloodstream, and, directly into the human brain.
A wild ride. But before we get completely lost in the chemistry and the culture of it all, we really need to lay down a very hard boundary for anyone listening.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, this is paramount because, we're going to discuss how this substance revolutionized 20th century pharmacology and led to all these life-saving medicines. But raw ergot itself is a lethal, agonizing poison.
Careful.
Exactly. It is not a natural remedy. It's not some alternative medicine. And it is certainly not a recreational substance. It is a biological toxin.
So basically, don't go looking for it.
Please don't. Consuming it in its raw form will not give you a pleasant psychedelic trip. It will put you in the hospital or the morgue.
Right. A crucial disclaimer.
Oh, yeah.
The natural form is an absolute nightmare. So let's go back to that medieval French village.
Okay.
Before we talk about the lab coats and the counterculture of the 1960s, we really have to understand the monster in the fields. What exactly is ergot? Because I'll be honest, before I read the source material, if you had asked me, I probably would have guessed ergot was like a weed.
Yeah, that's actually the most common misconception. People think it's a botanical issue, like a toxic root that accidentally gets picked with the harvest.
Right.
But ergot is not a plant at all. It is a fungal disease. Specifically, it's an ascomycete fungus known by the scientific name Claviceps purpurea.
Claviceps purpurea.
Yeah, and if you break down that Latin, it translates roughly to the purple club-headed fungus.
Which, I mean, that paints a rather ominous picture right from the start.
It really does.
So, how does a purple club-headed fungus end up in a medieval peasant's loaf of bread?
Well, it's a masterclass in biological infiltration. So this fungus primarily infects grasses, but its most historically significant victim by far is rye.
Okay, rye.
Now picture a field of rye waving in the wind. The fungus doesn't infect the leaves or the roots down in the soil. It waits for the rye plant to flower.
Ah, sneaky.
Very. The spores of the fungus are carried by the wind or sometimes by insects, and they land directly on the delicate developing ovary of the rye flower.
So it attacks the reproductive system of the crop.
Exactly. And once that spore lands, it essentially hijacks the plant.
Just takes it completely over.
Right. It consumes the developing seed of the grain entirely and replaces that natural kernel of rye with its own biological structure. It basically builds a replacement part.
Okay, I'm trying to picture what a farmer would actually see here. Like, if I'm harvesting this rye, wouldn't I notice that my crop has been replaced by a fungus?
You would if you looked really closely. But agricultural quality control in the 9th century wasn't exactly rigorous.
Fair point.
What the fungus creates is a hard, dark, slightly curved body called a sclerotium. This is the actual quote-unquote ergot.
The sclerotium.
Yeah. So if you were to look at an infected stalk of rye just before harvest, you wouldn't just see the normal golden brown kernels. You would see these purple-black, horn-like spurs poking out of the cereal heads.
The source describes them as looking almost like the claws of a small animal, or like rooster spurs.
Exactly. And if it's been a particularly damp, cold, wet spring, which is just the perfect breeding ground for Claviceps purpurea, those dark spurs can be everywhere in a field.
So the farmer just scythes the field, gathers the crop, and all these dark top fungal bodies get mixed right in with the healthy grain.
Yeah, they go straight into the mill, they get ground into flour, and they get baked into bread.
Okay, so the fungus is in the bread, but what is it actually doing? Because eating a mushroom doesn't normally rot your hand off.
Usually not, no.
There has to be a specific chemical payload inside that dark little spur, right?
Yes, and inside that sclerotium, the fungus is running a highly specialized chemical factory. And this is where the biology gets truly fascinating.
Okay.
The fungus absorbs a very common, everyday amino acid called tryptophan from the rye plant.
Hold on. Tryptophan? Like the stuff in turkey that supposedly makes you sleepy on Thanksgiving?
The very same.
Yeah.
It's an essential amino acid found in all sorts of standard dietary foods. Yeah. I mean, dairy, poultry, nuts.
Wow.
Yeah. The fungus takes this completely mundane building block, tryptophan, and uses it to construct a highly complex, incredibly potent cocktail of toxins known as ergot alkaloids.
Alkaloids. I mean, we hear that word a lot. Caffeine is an alkaloid. Nicotine is an alkaloid. What does that actually mean in this specific context?
So in broad terms, an alkaloid is a class of naturally occurring organic compounds that contain at least one nitrogen atom. Mm-hmm. And they almost always have profound, often drastic physiological effects on humans and other animals.
So they mess with our systems.
Heavily. In the case of ergot, the fungus produces a whole family of these alkaloids. You have ergotamine, ergonovine, ergocristine, and dozens of others.
And why is the fungus making them? I mean, is it actively trying to kill us?
Evolutionarily speaking, it doesn't care about humans at all.
Just collateral damage.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's likely a defense mechanism. The fungus is protecting its sclerotium, which is basically its overwintering survival pod, from being eaten by insects or grazing animals.
Oh, I see.
It just so happens that humans process grains on an industrial scale, so we ended up dosing entire populations with this defensive chemical weapon.
And this brings us to the most crucial point in this early part of the narrative. Our source stresses this heavily. All of those different complex alkaloids, ergotamine, ergonovine, whatever, they all share one core, identical chemical skeleton.
Yes. If you look at their molecular structure, they all have the exact same chassis. And that central chemical core is lysergic acid.
Lysergic acid. That is the biological root of this entire story.
It really is.
So our medieval peasants have just eaten bread laced with a cocktail of lysergic acid-based alkaloids. What happens to their bodies? Because the historical record calls this St. Anthony's fire.
Right. The poisoning manifests as a chronic condition known as ergotism. And it historically presented in two distinct, horrifying forms.
Let's start with the one that gives the disease its name, the fire, the gangrenous form.
Yes, the gangrenous form. To understand this one, we have to look at what those specific alkaloids, particularly the ergotamine-type alkaloids, do to the human cardiovascular system.
Okay.
Ergotamine is a massively powerful vasoconstrictor.
Vasoconstrictor meaning it shrinks the blood vessels.
It violently forces them to squeeze shut. Imagine a garden hose and you suddenly clamp down on it with a pair of pliers.
Wow.
Ergotamine does that to your vascular system.
Yeah.
And it specifically targets the small peripheral blood vessels, the ones feeding the very extremities of your body, your fingers, your toes, your ears, the tip of your nose.
So it clamps those tiny vessels completely shut, meaning literally no blood is getting through.
Zero blood flow. Which means zero oxygen and zero nutrients are reaching those tissues. The tissue begins to starve.
And that's where the pain comes in.
Exactly. As the nerves in those extremities begin to scream for oxygen, the victim experiences a burning, searing, unquenchable pain. It feels as if their limbs are literally on fire.
Hence, St. Anthony's fire.
Yes.
That is just horrific. And because they keep eating the contaminated bread every single day, the vessels just stay clamped shut.
And eventually, the tissue simply dies from asphyxiation. This is a condition known as dry gangrene. The limb turns pitch black, it mummifies, and eventually the dead tissue literally separates from the living tissue.
The source quotes a 9th century chronicle that is just chilling to read. It describes a plague in France as, quote, a great plague of swollen blisters so that their limbs were loosened and fell off before death.
Literally falling apart while still breathing.
My God.
And the name St. Anthony's Fire actually comes from the monks of the Order of St. Anthony, who established hospitals all across Europe to care for these victims.
What could they even do for them back then?
Not much, honestly. They would paint the blackened limbs with pork fat to try and soothe the burning, and they performed countless amputations. This gangrenous form was geographically very common in Western Europe, particularly in France.
But there's a second face to this monster. Because not everyone's limbs rotted off, some people experience something arguably worse, the convulsive form.
If the gangrenous form was a physical torture, the convulsive form was a complete neurological collapse.
And this was geographically different, right?
Yes. Historians and toxicologists believe this geographical split, where the convulsive form was much more common east of the Rhine River in places like Germany and Russia, was largely dependent on the specific strain of the Claviceps purpurea fungus.
So different soil, different weather, different toxins.
Exactly. The exact mix of alkaloids it was producing varied based on the local environment.
So if you were unlucky enough to live in a region with the convulsive strain, what did that look like?
The symptoms were just a cascade of agony.
Yeah.
It started with painful seizures, violent muscle spasms that were so severe they could contort the body into impossible, unnatural shapes.
That's uncontrollable flexing.
Yes. And sufferers reported formication, which is the intense, maddening sensation of insects crawling on or just under the skin.
Which would drive anyone completely insane on its own.
Absolutely. And then you combine that with intolerable itching, severe gastrointestinal distress, and then the mental effects take over.
Hallucinations.
Deep psychosis, mania, and vivid, terrifying hallucinations. Mm. People believed they were being actively attacked by demons. They saw the fires of hell. They just lost all tether to reality.
When you lay it out like that, I mean, it's no wonder they thought it was supernatural. You have an entire village suddenly seizing, hallucinating, and screaming about demons.
It looks exactly like a demonic possession from the outside.
Exactly. How vast were these outbreaks? Are we talking about a few dozen people here and there?
The historical scale is apocalyptic. I mean, the source article notes there are over 83 documented major epidemics of ergotism in Europe.
83?
Yeah. In 944 AD, an outbreak swept through France, causing mass gangrene and mass psychosis simultaneously, killing tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. From bread.
From bread. Much later, in 1778, an epidemic in the Salone region of France killed over 8,000 people in a single event.
8,000 people dead just from eating dinner.
Right.
Now, I want to pause here for a second because our source does something I really appreciate. It acts as a sort of referee for historical accuracy.
Right.
Because if anyone listening to this goes down an internet rabbit hole about ergotism, they are almost guaranteed to find articles claiming that a modern outbreak of St. Anthony's Fire happened in 1951 in a French village called Pont-Saint-Esprit.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
The Pain Maudé.
I took her hard.
It's a very famous case.
Yeah.
Hundreds of people went mad. They experienced terrifying hallucinations. Some even threw themselves out of windows.
Mm-hmm.
Popular history loves to definitively label this as a 20th century ergotism outbreak.
But our source is pumping the brakes on that pretty hard.
Significantly. The OTW Journal article is very careful to clarify that the scientific and historical consensus on Pont-Saint-Esprit is actually fiercely disputed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Careful toxicologists only describe that 1951 event as something akin to ergot poisoning. There are highly credible competing theories. Some suggest it was widespread mercury poisoning from a fungicide used on the grain, or maybe a different chemical contaminant entirely.
Got it. So we have to flag that as a debated hypothesis rather than a hard proven fact of the ergot timeline.
Exactly. We don't need 1951 to prove how dangerous this is anyway. The medieval record is undisputed.
So let me try to picture this biological mechanism. We have this fungus, right? It feels like. Okay, imagine a biological Trojan horse.
Oh, I think I see where you're going. Let's unpack that.
So the medieval baker is gathering grain. The fungus has evolved to disguise itself, at least at a quick glance, as a slightly oversized dark grain of rye.
Sneaking it.
Right. It gets ground up, baked, and sneaks right past the defenses of the village, right onto the dinner table. It looks like sustenance, but secretly, inside that dark little kernel, it is packed with a chemical army of alkaloids.
A literal army. Yeah.
And once you swallow it, that army deploys out of the stomach into the bloodstream, and its sole mission is to violently seize control of the human vascular and nervous system. I mean, it's a total inside job.
It is a remarkably accurate analogy. It infiltrates the most fundamental, universal human act of survival eating bread and turns it into a mechanism for systemic biochemical collapse.
It's grim. We've definitely established the terror here. But here is where the narrative takes a massive pivot.
Yes, the modern era.
Because every single one of those toxic, limb-rotting, hallucination-inducing alkaloids is built on that exact same foundation, the lysergic acid core. And in the 20th century, scientists looked at that core and realized they could isolate it.
And that realization takes us away from the plagued wheat fields of medieval France and into a pristine, highly organized laboratory in Basel, Switzerland.
We are talking about Sandoz laboratories in the 1930s. Enter a chemist named Albert Hofmann.
A very important figure.
Now, Hofmann is an absolute legend in counterculture and psychedelic history today. But when he was working with Ergot in 1938, what was his actual mandate? Because I assume a major Swiss pharmaceutical company wasn't paying him to invent a drug that would eventually fuel the 1960s.
Not at all. Sandoz was a highly pragmatic, profit-driven pharmaceutical company. They knew that ergot compounds had powerful demonstrable effects on the human body.
Like the vasoconstriction.
Exactly. They knew about the vasoconstriction. They knew it could stimulate muscle tissue. So Hofmann's job was to systematically break down these dangerous ergot alkaloids, isolate that lysergic acid core, and synthesize entirely new compounds from it.
He was trying to tame the beast.
Yes.
He wanted to strip away the gangrene and keep the useful parts. What exactly was Sandoz hoping to cure?
His specific goal in this project was to find a circulatory and respiratory stimulant, an analeptic.
Okay, to stimulate blood flow.
Right. They were looking for a medicine that could stimulate the nervous system and blood flow in a medically useful, controllable way, perhaps for patients with respiratory depression or severe circulatory issues.
Okay, so Hofmann isolates the lysergic acid, and he begins a very tedious, methodical process of combining it with various other molecules to see what happens. I mean, chemistry in the 1930s wasn't like today. It was grueling, hands-on work.
Very grueling. He creates a whole series of compounds. He makes the first one, tests it, nothing useful. He makes the second one, the third one, and so on.
Trial and error.
A lot of error. But eventually, he creates the 25th compound in this specific series.
He creates it by combining the lysergic acid core with a chemical called diethylamine?
Precisely. Lysergic acid diethylamide. Or, as it was neatly cataloged in the Sandoz lab records, LSD-25.
LSD-25 is born in 1938, and this is the part of the story that always amazes me. He synthesizes it, they hand it over to the pharmacology department, they test it on laboratory animals, and basically nothing happens.
The pharmacological reports from 1938 were incredibly underwhelming.
Like nothing at all.
Well, the researchers noted that the animals, likely mice or cats, became slightly restless. But otherwise, the compound showed, quote, nothing remarkable.
Wow.
It didn't significantly stimulate circulation or respiration the way Sandoz was hoping for. It was deemed a failure.
So they literally put it on a shelf, the most profoundly powerful psychoactive substance ever synthesized up to that point in human history. And it just sits in a dark cabinet in Switzerland, completely forgotten for 5 years.
It is one of the great absurd ironies of scientific history. But, you know, Hofmann wasn't just a technician. He was a highly intuitive chemist.
He had a feeling.
He did. He wrote years later that he just couldn't stop thinking about LSD-25. He had what he described as a peculiar presentiment, a gut feeling that the initial animal tests hadn't revealed the whole picture of what this molecule was capable of.
Which brings us to a date that fundamentally altered human culture. Friday, April 16th, 1943. The accidental doorway.
Yes. Hofmann decides, acting entirely on this unscientific hunch, to synthesize a fresh batch of LSD-25 so he can run more tests.
And while he's working with it, purifying the crystals, he accidentally absorbs a trace amount. The source says it was through his fingertips. Now, wait a minute. You can absorb a drug just by touching it.
Usually the skin is a fantastic barrier, but LSD is profoundly potent, and it is highly lipophilic, which means it dissolves easily in fats and lipids.
Oh, I see.
Human skin is covered in natural oils and has a lipid layer. So a microscopic speck of MSD dust or a tiny drop of solution absorbed transdermally through the skin or accidentally rubbed into an eye is more than enough to cross the threshold of psychoactivity.
So he absorbs an invisible amount. He has to stop working because he feels strange. He goes home. And we actually have his diary notes from that afternoon.
We do. He describes a sudden extreme dizziness, a dreamlike state, and what he called a not unpleasant intoxication.
But it's the visual descriptions that prove he breached a new frontier, right?
Definitely. He wrote about closing his eyes and seeing an uninterrupted stream of extraordinary shapes with intense kaleidoscopic play of colors.
He is experiencing the very first LSD trip in human history entirely by accident.
Completely unintentional. And he doesn't have the vocabulary for it. The word psychedelic won't even be invented for another decade. But he knows exactly what caused it.
Right, because he's a rigorous, maybe slightly obsessive scientist. He knows the intoxication is connected to the LSD-25 he was handling. So he decides he needs to test it deliberately on himself to be absolutely sure.
Which leads us to the following Monday, April 19th, 1943.
The day.
The day. Hoffman goes back into the Sandoz lab. He's going to run a deliberate self-experiment.
Okay, I have to stop here because this is where the story gets really wild. He prepares a dose. And our source notes, he takes what he assumes is a tiny, incredibly cautious, almost imperceptible dose. 250 micrograms.
To give the listener a sense of scale here, a microgram is 1/1000th of a gram. So 250 micrograms is 0.25 milligrams.
Right. So as a chemist in the 1940s, Hoffman is used to working with drugs that are active in the milligram or even the nettogram range. I mean, a standard Tylenol today is, what, 500 milligrams?
Exactly. Even potent medicines of his day usually required several milligrams to feel any effect. So to Hoffman's mind, 0.25 milligrams is basically a rounding error. It's a fraction of a speck of dust.
He probably thought nothing would happen.
He figured he would drink it, feel absolutely no effect at all, and then maybe he'd slowly increase the dose over the next few weeks.
I have to laugh at his idea of caution here, because looking at it through a modern pharmacological lens, 250 micrograms of LSD is a massive dose.
It is a profound, fully immersive, ego-dissolving, heavy dose. What Hoffman didn't know, what literally no one in the world knew yet, is just how unprecedentedly potent the lysergic acid backbone becomes when it's modified into LSD.
It's just off the charts.
It is orders of magnitude more potent by weight than almost any other known psychoactive compound.
So he drinks this glass of water containing his cautious 250 micrograms, and within 40 minutes, his reality begins to severely fracture. The laboratory starts morphing. He realizes he has made a massive miscalculation, and he needs to get home immediately.
But there's a historical complication here. This is 1943. World War II is raging just across the border.
Right.
And because of the war, there are severe fuel restrictions in Switzerland, and civilian cars are largely banned from the roads.
So he can't get a cab. His only option to get home is his bicycle. And he's tripping so hard, he asks his laboratory assistant to escort him.
This is the legendary ride. Albert Hoffman pedaling through the streets of Basel, peaking on 250 micrograms of pharmaceutical-grade LSD.
His own description of the journey is terrifying. He felt like he was paralyzed, completely stationary, even though his assistant later said they were pedaling at a rapid pace.
On violation.
Yeah. He wrote that the houses and objects in his vision were wavering and distorted, as if seen in a convex mirror. And when he finally got home, he thought his friendly neighbor who brought him milk was a malevolent witch wearing a colored mask.
Yeah, he genuinely thought he had poisoned himself and was dying.
It was a classic, overwhelming psychedelic crisis. I mean, he was experiencing a massive accidental overdose in a completely uncontrolled, highly anxious setting. He even called for a doctor.
And the doctor arrives, examines the terrified chemist, and finds absolutely nothing physically wrong with him.
Nothing.
Nothing. His blood pressure is fine. His heart rate is fine. The only physiological symptom the doctor can find is extremely dilated pupils.
That's wild.
And eventually, the sheer terror subsides, and Hoffman transitions into a state of profound awe, gratitude, and a feeling of deep connection to nature.
And that harrowing commute is now permanently etched into cultural history.
It is. It's commemorated globally every year by psychedelic advocates and researchers as Bicycle Day.
Although the source article points out a rather funny cultural footnote about that.
Yeah, the dates.
Right. People celebrate Bicycle Day on April 19th, but the term Bicycle Day wasn't even coined until 1985 by a professor in Illinois. And people constantly blur the timeline.
They do. April 16th was the accidental gentle discovery. April 19th was the intentional overwhelming bike ride.
It's just an amazing story. But here is where the science takes another fascinating turn. Because while Hoffman revolutionized chemistry with this synthetic creation, this lysergic lineage isn't exclusively a product of a 20th century Swiss laboratory.
No, the chemistry goes much deeper into the natural botanical world.
The OTW Journal article highlights a vital natural cousin to all this. We mentioned that ergot contains a cocktail of alkaloids. One of the naturally occurring compounds inside that medieval fungal spur is something called lysergic acid amide, LSA.
Also known scientifically as ergin.
And this is where my mind was truly blown. LSA is the exact same gentle lysergamide that is found in the seeds of the morning glory flower and in the seeds of the Hawaiian baby wood rose.
It is chemically identical.
So wait, the exact same chemical family that was burning limbs in medieval Europe and that Hoffman was modifying in a lab is found naturally in these beautiful flowering vines that indigenous cultures in the Americas like the Zapotec and the Aztec have used as sacred visionary plant sacraments for centuries.
It is a remarkable three-way lineage. Ergot sits right at the center of the web.
Wow.
It is the dark fungal bridge that connects the medieval European poison, the ancient Mesoamerican plant sacrament, and the modern synthetic psychedelic. They all branch off from that one shared liturgic core.
Okay, so we've covered the history. We know what happened to the peasants in France. Their limbs died. We know what happened to Albert Hoffman on his bicycle. His reality melted, but we desperately need to understand why.
This is the biological paradox. How can the same structural family of molecules cause dry gangrene in a farmer and ego dissolution in a chemist? It seems completely contradictory.
Right. I mean, if I take a Tylenol, my fever goes down. If you take a Tylenol, your fever goes down. But here, one version of the molecule destroys the body, and a slightly tweaked version completely spares the body and reorganizes the mind. It makes no intuitive sense.
To understand the why, we have to abandon the macroscopic view of history and zoom all the way down to the cellular level. We have to look at receptors and gateways inside the human body.
Let's do it. Our source calls these ergot alkaloids promiscuous mimics, which is a great phrase, but what does it actually mean in pharmacology?
Let's define a receptor first. Think of a receptor as a very specific lock on the surface of a human cell.
Okay.
Normally, the human body produces its own specific keys, these are neurotransmitters, like serotonin or dopamine, to open those locks and tell the cell what to do. Serotonin keys only open serotonin locks. Dopamine keys only open dopamine locks. It's a highly regulated system.
But the ergot alkaloids don't respect that system. They are biological lockpicks.
Exactly. When the article calls them promiscuous, it means they don't just target one specific lock. They act across three entirely different major receptor systems in the human body.
They just blast across the whole neurochemical spectrum.
Yes. They hit serotonin receptors, which are abbreviated scientifically as 5-HT. They hit dopamine receptors.
Yeah.
And they hit adrenergic receptors, which are the locks that usually respond to adrenaline and noradrenaline.
So they're everywhere.
And it gets more complicated. They act as what pharmacologists call partial agonists and antagonists.
Meaning?
Meaning sometimes an ergot alkaloid will pick a lock and turn the system on. That's an agonist. And sometimes it will slide into the lock, snap off, jam the mechanism, and prevent the body's own natural neurotransmitters from working. That's an antagonist.
Just chaos.
It creates a chaotic interference pattern across the entire nervous system.
And this leads us directly to the great paradox that the article highlights, the side-by-side comparison between ergotamine, the medieval poison, and LSD.
This is the crux of the entire mystery. Let's look closely at ergotamine. When modern scientists analyze ergotamine in a petri dish, they find that it is a highly potent agonist at a very specific serotonin receptor called the 5-HT2A receptor.
Okay, wait. If you know anything about modern psychedelic science, your jaw just dropped. Because the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor is universally recognized as the classic psychedelic target.
Precisely.
It is the exact receptor that psilocybin mushrooms hit, that DMT hits, that mescaline hits.
If a drug strongly activates the 5-HT2A receptor in the brain, it almost universally causes profound alterations in consciousness, visual geometry, and hallucinations.
But hold on, this is where I get confused. If ergotamine powerfully hits the exact same psychedelic receptor as LSD, why doesn't ergotamine cause hallucinations? Why did the gangrenous form of St. Anthony's fire just cause burning limbs, but no visions?
It's the most logical question to ask. And the answer is not about the chemistry of the drug itself. The answer is pharmacokinetic.
Pharmacokinetic?
Yes. It's entirely about how the human body distributes the drug. It's about the blood-brain barrier.
Okay, I've heard of the blood-brain barrier, but what actually is it physically? Is it a membrane? A filter?
It is an incredibly selective, highly defensive fortress wall that protects your central nervous system. The blood vessels that feed your brain are different from the blood vessels in your arm.
How so?
In your arm, the cells lining the blood vessels have tiny gaps between them, allowing nutrients and chemicals to easily pass into the surrounding tissue.
Like a soaker hose in a garden.
Yes, great analogy. But in the brain, those endothelial cells are packed tightly together by what are called tight junctions. There are no gaps.
Total seal.
On top of that, the barrier is highly lipid-based, made of fats. Its sole purpose is to prevent toxins, bacteria, and unwanted chemicals in your bloodstream from entering the delicate environment of your brain.
So if a chemical wants to get into the brain, it has to be small enough or fat-soluble enough to sneak through those tightly packed lipid cells.
Exactly. And it turns out ergotamine, the raw medieval poison, is a very bulky, cumbersome, water-soluble molecule.
It can't get past the bouncers at the club.
It really can't. Scientific studies show that only about 1% of the ergotamine you ingest actually manages to cross the blood-brain barrier into the brain. The other 99% is locked out.
Oh, wow.
It is trapped circulating in the peripheral bloodstream of your body.
So because 99% of it's locked out of the brain, its massive promiscuous action on all those serotonin and adrenaline receptors plays out entirely in the body, not the mind.
You've got it. It is circulating in your limbs, gripping those alpha-adrenergic receptors, forcing the blood vessels to violently constrict and causing the dry gangrene. It never reaches the 5-HT2A receptors in the cerebral cortex in high enough concentrations to cause a psychedelic trip.
But LSD is different.
Fundamentally different. Remember Albert Hofmann in 1938? When he attached that diethylamine group to the lysergic acid core, he completely changed the molecule's physical properties.
He tweaked the key.
He inadvertently made LSD highly lipophilic, extremely fat-soluble, and perfectly shaped to slip right through the lipid layers of the blood-brain barrier.
It just glides right past the fortress wall.
Effortlessly. Once it enters the central nervous system, LSD bypasses the peripheral blood vessels entirely and heads straight for the cerebral cortex. It finds those 5-HT2A receptors on the cortical neurons, slides into the locks, and lights them up.
And what happens when those specific receptors in the cortex get lit up? Because the source mentions something called the default mode network.
Yes, the collapse of the default mode network, or DMN. Think of the DMN as the brain central CEO.
Okay.
It is a network of brain regions responsible for maintaining our rigid sense of ego, our autobiographical memory, and the boundary between self and other. It's the voice in your head that says, I am me, and the table is the table.
It keeps us functional and grounded.
Right. But when LSD massively activates the 5-HT2A receptors, the CEO essentially gets locked out of the office. The rigid control of the default mode network breaks down.
And then what?
Brain regions that normally never communicate with each other suddenly start firing together. The visual cortex starts talking to the emotional centers. That hyperconnectivity is what produces the visionary state, the synesthesia, and the profound ego dissolution Hofmann experienced.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to synthesize all this, because the mechanics are just wild.
Sure.
Okay, so imagine the blood-brain barrier is a massive, heavily guarded security gate at the entrance to a private estate. And the 5-HT2A receptor is the lock on the front door of the mansion inside.
I like this. Let's see how it plays out.
Ergotamine and LSD are both keys that are perfectly cut to fit the lock on the front door. But first, they have to get past the security gate.
Right.
Ergotamine shows up and it's too big. It doesn't have the VIP pass, so the guards won't let it in. It gets stuck outside in the yard, but it's still a key and it's restless. So it starts jamming itself into everything it can find in the yard.
The other receptors?
Yeah. It jams itself into the controls for the sprinkler system, which in our biology is the blood vessels. It turns the sprinklers on full blast, flooding the yard, causing absolute physical chaos, but it never gets inside the house.
That is the vascular effect, the gangrene.
Right. But LSD shows up, and it has Hofmann's diethylamine modification, which acts like a VIP badge. The guards at the blood-brain barrier take one look at its lipophilic structure and wave it right through.
Straight past the gate.
LSD walks smoothly past the yard, goes straight up to the mansion, slides perfectly into the 5-HT2A lock on the front door, opens it up, and proceeds to completely rearrange all the furniture in the brain.
That is an absolutely superb way to visualize it. It is the exact same receptor target, the exact same lock, but the molecules suffer completely opposite destinies based purely on their travel itinerary inside the human body.
It is staggering when you really think about it. The molecule itself doesn't change what it intrinsically wants to do. The body just dictates where it is physically allowed to do it.
Exactly.
And once 20th century pharmaceutical scientists truly understood this mechanism, how these molecules functioned at the receptor level, a massive collective light bulb went off.
Because they realized that if they could map these receptor affinities, they could selectively tame the poison.
Which launches us into the next phase of our journey. From poison to pharmacy, the modern medical miracles and the dark sides of ergot. Because if the pharmaceutical industry knows that ergamine powerfully constricts blood vessels, they have to ask, how can we use that specific violent mechanism to save lives instead of destroying them?
And the answers they found completely revolutionized several fields of modern medicine. Let's start with neurology, specifically the treatment of severe migraines.
If you've ever had a migraine, you know it's not just a bad headache. It's incredibly debilitating. And physiologically, a migraine involves the massive dilation, the swelling, of blood vessels inside the brain, right?
Correct. During a migraine, cranial blood vessels expand and throb, pressing against highly sensitive nerve endings, causing immense blinding pain.
Yeah.
Scientists realized that if they could harness ergotamine's vasoconstrictive power, its ability to forcibly shrink blood vessels, they might be able to abort a migraine in progress.
So they developed targeted drugs using ergotamine and a derivative called dihydroergotamine.
Yes. These medications selectively activate specific serotonin receptors, the 5-HT1B and 5-HT1D receptors. When those receptors are activated, they precisely constrict those painfully dilated cranial vessels, reducing the pressure on the nerves and stopping the migraine pain in its tracks.
That is wild. The exact same mechanism that caused gangrene in a medieval peasant's foot is deliberately harnessed in a controlled dose to relieve a migraine in a modern patient. It's like pharmacological judo.
It really is.
But it goes beyond just migraines. The source goes heavily into obstetrics.
This is arguably where ergot derivatives have saved the most lives globally. Think back to the convulsive spasms caused by St. Anthony's Fire. The violent, uncontrollable muscle contractions.
Yeah, the terrifying seizing we talked about.
Well, the uterus is a massive, powerful muscle. After a woman gives birth, one of the greatest immediate medical risks is postpartum hemorrhage severe, uncontrollable bleeding from the site where the placenta detached.
Which was, historically, and still is in many parts of the world, a leading cause of maternal mortality.
Exactly. Chemists isolated another specific ergot alkaloid called ergometrine, also known as ergonovine. They also created a highly stable semi-synthetic cousin called methylergonovine, which is widely marketed today under the brand name Methergine.
And how do they use it?
If a mother begins to hemorrhage after delivery, doctors administer this ergot derivative. It uses that intense muscle contracting property to forcefully and rapidly clamp the uterine muscle shut.
Oh, I see.
By aggressively contracting the uterus, it squeezes the bleeding blood vessels closed,
right,
effectively acting like an internal tourniquet, and stops the hemorrhage.
So if you are listening to this and you or someone you love had a difficult childbirth involving a hemorrhage, there is a very real chance that a derivative of this medieval rye malt is the reason they survive.
A very real chance.
That is a direct life-saving application of what was once considered a demonic curse. And the source mentions a third medical field, endocrinology and neurology, specifically involving the dopamine system.
Right. We established earlier that ergot alkaloids are promiscuous and also hit dopamine receptors.
Yeah.
Chemists developed specific derivatives like bromocriptine and cabergoline that act as powerful dopamine agonists. They pick the dopamine lock and turn the system on.
Why do we want to turn the dopamine system on?
It is crucial for treating Parkinson's disease, which is a neurodegenerative disorder characterized by a severe lack of dopamine in the brain. Mm. Giving a patient a dopamine agonist helps restore motor function.
That's amazing.
And these drugs are also used in endocrinology to shrink prolactin-secreting tumors in the pituitary gland. Dopamine naturally inhibits the production of the hormone prolactin, so an ergot-derived dopamine agonist acts as a targeted therapy to shrink the tumor.
Okay, I have to step back. We have migraine cures, we have life-saving obstetric hemorrhage drugs, and we have treatments for Parkinson's and brain tumors, all isolated from this black toxic mold on a stalk of rye. It sounds like an absolute unmitigated pharmaceutical triumph.
It is a massive triumph, but we have a strict obligation to discuss the shadow here. The OTW Journal article is very clear about this. There is a dark side to this pharmacy.
The dark side, because the lockpicks are promiscuous.
Exactly. Because these molecules are promiscuous, they don't just hit the specific receptors we want them to hit for a migraine or for Parkinson's. They also bind to other receptors as unintended off-target effects.
And what's the worst one?
The most dangerous off-target lock they pick is the 5-HT2B receptor.
The 5-HT2B receptor. What happens when an ergot drug chronically activates that lock?
Medical science has discovered, through painful experience, that chronic, long-term activation of the 5-HT2B receptor causes severe fibrosis.
Fibrosis. Explain what that looks like in the body. Is it scarring?
Yes. It is a dangerous, inappropriate thickening and scarring of connective tissues, specifically targeting the delicate valves of the heart and the tissue of the lungs.
Oh, that's not good.
The heart valves are supposed to be thin, flexible flaps that ensure blood flows in only one direction. Fibrosis causes them to become thick, stiff, and dysfunctional. The heart begins to fail.
That sounds incredibly dangerous. Has this actually happened to patients taking these ergot-derived medications?
Tragically, yes. This isn't just theoretical receptor science. The historical proof is right there in the FDA regulatory records. In 2007, an ergot-derived dopamine agonist called Pergolide, which was widely prescribed for Parkinson's disease, was entirely pulled from the U.S. market.
Removed completely.
Completely banned. Because epidemiological studies heavily linked daily Pergolide used to severe valvular heart disease in patients. And Cabergoline, the other tumor-shrinking drug we mentioned, carries this exact same strict black box warning today.
Wait, if Cabergoline scars the heart valves, why are doctors still prescribing it?
Because this raises a fundamental tenet of pharmacology. The dose makes the poison. The risk of 5-HT2B fibrosis is highly, highly dose-dependent.
Okay.
The heart valve damage largely occurred at the very high daily doses historically required to treat Parkinson's disease. But for treating prolactin-secreting tumors, Cabergoline is incredibly effective at much, much lower doses, often requiring a patient to take it just once or twice a week.
So it's manageable.
At those microdoses, the risk of fibrosis is vastly reduced, though patients are still carefully monitored with echocardiograms.
It is a delicate, high-stakes balancing act. So let me synthesize this. Does this mean the exact same promiscuous mechanism that makes ergot a miracle for a migrainer or a lifesaver for a hemorrhaging mother is the exact same mechanism that makes it a lethal liability for the heart?
In a sense, yes. It perfectly summarizes the double-edged sword of non-selective receptor binding. When you deploy a biological lockpick into the human body, you are going to successfully open the doors you desperately wanted to open, but you are also going to inevitably open a few doors you desperately wanted to stay shut.
Which is why these compounds require such profound medical respect and oversight.
Exactly.
Which brings up the legal and safety realities in our current year, 2026. The article makes a point to explicitly outline the legal framework.
It has to, because the chemical lineage is so intertwined, even the purely medical derivatives are heavily controlled. Ergotamine isn't just a simple migraine drug. It is heavily regulated as a US DEA List I chemical.
Because if you have ergotamine, you have the lysergic acid core.
Exactly. It is the direct feedstock, the primary precursor chemical, required for the illicit synthesis of LSD. You can't just call up a chemical supply company and buy a barrel of ergotamine.
Right.
And raw lysergic acid itself is heavily monitored and regulated by international treaties.
The legal framework is forced to recognize both its vital medical utility and its immense reality-altering psychoactive potential. It's a molecule that demands absolute regulation.
Without a doubt.
Okay. We've traced the biology, the dark history, the chemistry, and the complex pharmacology. But a substance this incredibly potent, capable of causing both mass hysteria in a medieval village and mystical visions in a Swiss lab, inevitably becomes a magnet for historical theories.
It undeniably captures the imagination. When historians and anthropologists look back at bizarre, seemingly inexplicable events in human history, mass panics, strange cults, they often go searching for a hidden chemical culprit.
Which leads us to the final major section of our source material: myths, witches, and ancient mysteries. We are going to look at how the ergot fungus has been used by modern thinkers to try and neatly solve two of history's greatest mysteries, and why, as critical thinkers, we have to be extremely careful with these seductive hypotheses.
Let's start with the most famous one in American history, Salem, Massachusetts, 1692.
The Salem witch trials. We all know the basic story. The sudden fits, the young girls screaming in the courtroom, claiming they were being pinched and bitten by invisible specters, the terrifying hallucinations, the eventual executions.
A dark chapter.
For centuries, historians have debated the cause. Was it mass sociological hysteria? Was it strict Puritan sexual repression boiling over? Were the teenagers just lying for attention?
It remained a sociological mystery. But in 1976, a behavioral scientist named Linda Caporal published a famous, highly controversial paper in the prestigious journal Science.
And what was her angle?
She proposed a radical, purely biological hypothesis. She argued that the bewitched girls of Salem weren't faking it, and they certainly weren't possessed by the devil. She argued they were suffering from an acute, localized outbreak of convulsive ergotism.
And her argument, on the surface, sounds incredibly compelling, right?
It did. She painted a very convincing environmental picture. She pointed out that the rye grown around Salem Village was cultivated in marshy, damp, low-lying fields, which we know are the exact perfect conditions for the Claviceps purpurea fungus to thrive.
A perfect breeding ground.
Furthermore, she aligned the specific weather patterns of 1691 and 1692, a warm, wet spring followed by a hot summer, with the exact timeline of the girl's symptoms. It provided a neat, elegant scientific explanation for supernatural chaos.
It's the ultimate historical aha moment. Like, it wasn't witches, it wasn't human cruelty, it was just moldy bread. But our source article is very quick to pump the brakes on this.
Very quick. Because the scientific community did not let Caporale's theory stand unchallenged. Within months of her publication, an immediate and devastating rebuttal was published in the exact same journal, Science, authored by two psychologists named Spanos and Gottlieb.
Okay, I want to unpack this rebuttal because it's a great lesson in critical thinking. What were Spanos and Gottlieb's main arguments against the ergot theory? Why doesn't it hold up?
First, they looked at the basic epidemiology of ergotism. Think back to our medieval French village. When a community eats poisoned bread from a communal mill, the poisoning strikes whole households indiscriminately.
Right. Everyone eats the bread.
You would see the mother, the father, the farmhands, and the children all convulsing and burning. But in Salem, the symptoms were highly specific to scattered individuals, mostly young girls and a few specific adults, while other people eating the exact same diet, living in the exact same household, showed absolutely zero symptoms.
That's a massive, glaring red flag. If the toxin is in the daily bread, everyone at the table gets sick.
Exactly. You can't selectively poison only the teenagers with a communal food source. Second, Spanos and Gottlieb went back to the original extensive Salem court records.
And what did they find?
They found that most of the classic physiological symptoms of convulsive ergotism were completely absent from the historical accounts.
What was missing?
Well, convulsive ergotism causes severe gastrointestinal distress, vomiting, and diarrhea. None of that was reported. It causes the painful crawling sensation under the skin, which wasn't widely described.
Oh, wow.
Most importantly, ergotism causes extreme, continuous muscle spasms. But the girls in Salem were remarkably able to turn their symptoms on and off, depending on the social situation.
Wait, really?
Yes, they would be fine. But the moment a specific accused witch walked into the courtroom, they would burst into fits. Ergotism doesn't care if you are on trial. It ravages your nervous system continuously.
Right. You can't just pause a biochemical neurotransmitter-driven seizure because the local magistrate is looking at you.
Furthermore, and this is a fascinating nutritional detail that toxicologists brought up, convulsive ergotism historically tends to take hold only in peasant populations suffering from severe vitamin A deficiency.
Why vitamin A?
Vitamin A is crucial for maintaining a healthy immune system and protecting the nervous system. Without it, the body is highly susceptible to the neurotoxins in ergot.
Okay.
But Salem, in 1692, was a thriving, agriculturally wealthy, dairy-rich colony. They had abundant access to milk, butter, and cheese, all of which are rich in vitamin A. They were not a starving, vitamin-deficient population.
So the biological groundwork for a mass convulsive outbreak just wasn't there.
It wasn't. And what is the verdict today? While Caporale's ergot theory remains immensely popular in pop culture, on forums, everywhere really, most modern historians, toxicologists, and medical anthropologists side firmly with the Spanos and Gottlieb rebuttal.
So they just reject it outright?
They reject the ergot theory for Salem. The witch trials were a vastly complex sociological, psychological, and political phenomenon involving land disputes, religious extremism, and misogyny. They cannot be comfortably reduced to a fungus.
Okay, so the Salem theory is likely a modern myth. But what about the older mystery, the one from ancient Greece? Because if ergot didn't cause the witch trials, did it birth Western philosophy?
Ah, the Eleusinian mysteries. This is a hypothesis that goes back two millennia and strikes at the heart of classical civilization.
Set the scene for us. For nearly 2,000 years, ancient Greek initiates would travel to a sanctuary at Eleusis near Athens. We are talking about cult members, famous philosophers like Plato, and even Roman emperors.
It was a huge deal.
They would participate in these highly secretive nocturnal rituals. They would drink a sacred barley potion called the Kaikion, and they would experience profound, life-altering, transformative visions that supposedly remove their fear of death.
It was the spiritual center of the ancient Mediterranean world. And the exact recipe of the Kaikion and the mechanism that caused those profound visions was kept a strict secret under penalty of death.
Enter the modern psychedelic pioneers to try and solve the riddle.
In 1978, a highly controversial and groundbreaking book was published called The Road to Eleusis. It was co-authored by a fascinating trio. R. Gordon Wasson, the banker who essentially introduced psilocybin mushrooms to Western culture, Carl Ruck, an eminent classical scholar, and none other than Albert Hoffman himself.
Hoffman again. The man who synthesized LSD is now trying to solve ancient Greek history. He is everywhere in this story.
He is the linchpin. The three of them proposed a daring interdisciplinary hypothesis. They argued that the sacred barley used to brew the Kaikion at Eleusis was deliberately infected with ergot.
But wait, if they drank a potion made of ergot, wouldn't they all just get St. Anthony's fire, get gangrene, and die?
This is exactly where Hoffman's chemical expertise came into play. Hoffman argued that the ancient Greek priests had intuitively figured out a specific low-temperature water extraction method.
Like a cold brew.
Basically. By steeping the infected barley in cold water, they hypothesized that the priests could extract the water-soluble psychoactive alkaloids, specifically LSA and ergonovine.
Which are the natural, gentle psychedelics we talked about earlier.
Yes. While crucial, the heavier non-water-soluble ergotamine alkaloids, the ones that clamp the blood vessels shut and cause gangrene, would be left behind in the fungal solid, which the priests would filter out.
So they were essentially brewing an ancient, natural, carefully filtered precursor to LSD.
That was the argument, that ergot, carefully managed by ancient botanists, was the secret psychedelic engine behind the greatest spiritual mystery of antiquity.
It's an incredibly romantic idea, but what is the actual evidence for this? Is there any physical proof that ancient cultures used ergot this way?
This is where the archaeology gets highly contested. The ODW Journal article notes that recent, very compelling archaeological excavations in Spain have actually found ergot residues inside ancient ritual vessels inside a cave.
No way.
Yes. This adds a massive amount of fuel to the fire and proves that some ancient cultures in the Mediterranean region were indeed aware of ergot and likely used it in rituals.
Wow. So they were definitely using it.
Some cultures were using it. However, applying that Spanish archaeological find directly to the specific cult at Eleusis in Greece is fiercely debated.
Of course it is.
Eminent mainstream classicists such as Walter Burkert have firmly rejected the ergot hypothesis for Eleusis. They argue that the ancient textual evidence doesn't support the brewing method, the agricultural realities of the Eleusinian plains don't support mass ergot cultivation, and the specific unified visions described by the initiates don't perfectly align with the unpredictable nature of ergot poisoning.
So what's the final honest verdict on Eleusis?
The verdict is that it remains a beautiful, seductive, and tantalizing possibility. It is entirely plausible chemically, thanks to Hoffman's theories, but we must be scientifically and historically honest. It is unproven. It is a hypothesis, not settled history.
You know, sitting here listening to this, it makes you reflect on why these theories, both Salem and Eleusis, are so incredibly popular with the public. Even when rigid historians and toxicologists push back with hard data, people desperately cling to the ergot theories. Why do you think that is?
I think it speaks to how we view history. History is fundamentally messy and human.
Exactly. The psychology of a witch hunt is dark, complex, and deeply uncomfortable to look at. The sheer mystery of ancient religious rites is frustrating because we are locked out. We can't fully know what they felt. I think it's the deeply human desire for a silver bullet explanation. We want a single, fascinating molecule to neatly explain away all the chaos of human behavior. It's so comforting to think, oh, it wasn't human cruelty and religious mania in Salem. It was just mold. Or the Greeks weren't tapping into some unreachable divine state. They were just tripping on infected barley.
That is a very astute observation. We project our modern chemical understanding backward in time to make the past feel more legible, more solvable, and ultimately less intimidating.
It's a great story, but sometimes the story is just a story. And as we've seen today, the actual proven history of ergot, the things we know it did in medieval Europe, in Hoffman's lab, and in modern hospitals, is honestly wild enough without needing to invent historical myths.
Agreed. The documented truth of this molecule is far stranger and far more complex than the historical fiction.
Which brings us to the honest bottom line of this entire deep dive. We've gone from the freezing, plagued wheat fields of 9th century France to a high-tech pharmaceutical lab in Switzerland. We've traveled through the microscopic lipid layers of the blood-brain barrier and into the contested courtrooms of Salem.
It's been quite the journey. If we synthesize it all, the overriding theme is one of profound, almost unsettling duality.
Yeah.
Ergot is, without a doubt, the darkest, most terrifying root of the entire psychedelic tree. It proves, both chemically and historically, how incredibly terrifyingly thin the line really is between poison, medicine, and revelation.
And what really strikes me, what I can't stop thinking about, is that the molecule itself has absolutely no intention. It's just a rigid shape made of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen.
Exactly.
It doesn't care if it's rotting the limbs off a peasant village, or stopping a new mother from bleeding to death, or dissolving the ego of a chemist on a bicycle.
The molecule is entirely neutral. It is the context that defines its reality. The exact dose, the precise chemical modifications made by brilliant chemists like Hoffman, and ultimately its final destination in the human body.
Whether it gets stopped at the gates of the blood-brain barrier or slips through into the cortex.
Yes, those physical parameters decide everything.
It's a humbling reminder of the sheer latent power locked inside the natural world. But before we wrap up today, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. Something that builds on the biology we talked about right at the very beginning of this deep dive, but that we didn't fully explore until now.
What's the thought?
Think back to the chemical factory operating inside that dark fungal spur. The source noted that Claviceps purpurea builds these world-altering, terrifying, hallucinogenic ergot alkaloids out of one specific amino acid.
Tryptophan.
Exactly. Tryptophan. Now, tryptophan is not some exotic, rare chemical found only in deep jungles. It is a basic, essential amino acid. It is a building block we get from everyday, mundane foods.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
It's in the milk you pour on your cereal. It's in the cheese you eat. It's famous for being in the turkey you eat on Thanksgiving.
It is entirely ubiquitous in the human diet.
Right. And in the human body, we take that tryptophan from our turkey sandwich, and our internal biology uses it to synthesize our own serotonin. Serotonin is the neurotransmitter that regulates our mood, our sleep, our digestion, and fundamentally maintains our normal waking baseline consciousness.
It is the neurochemical anchor that keeps us tied to reality.
Yes. So isn't it absolutely staggering to consider that the human brain and a terrifying medieval rye fungus are harvesting and utilizing the exact same everyday dietary building block?
They are pulling from the exact same raw material.
The exact same material. Inside us, our biology uses tryptophan to build the walls of our reality. It builds serotonin that keeps us sane, grounded, and functional.
Right.
But out there in the damp fields, inside the dark, curved spur of the ergot fungus, that exact same biological building block is being used to forge the chemical keys specifically designed to completely dismantle that reality.
It's poetic, really. The fundamental building block of human sanity is the exact same building block used by nature to construct madness, or, depending on how you view Hoffman's synthesis, transcendence.
It's all the exact same stuff. It just depends on who or what is doing the building. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this journey through the dark, strange, and illuminating history of ergot has changed the way you look at a simple loaf of bread, a bottle on a pharmacy shelf, and the incredibly delicate chemistry of your own mind.
Keep asking hard questions. Keep looking closer at the hidden mechanics of the natural world, and always challenge the simple narratives.
We will see you on the next deep dive.